You're listening to Midori House first broadcast on the 10th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show,
President Trump. I mean, Trump had those ideas, had that energy, had that vision that could galvanize a team around him. Look, we're a coalition. You know, a lot of people think, you know, have strong beliefs about different things, but we understand that you can come together to win. We understood that from August 15th, and we never had a doubt, and Donald Trump never had a doubt that he was going to win.
Steve Bannon there, back in February, a considerably happier time in his relationship with Donald Trump. Now, Bannon has stepped down from the right-wing Breitbart News organisation after a dramatic split with the man he helped bring to power. My guests, Joy Lodico and John Everard, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including new dialogue between North and South Korea has already secured the North a place in next month's Winter Olympics. How much more is it sensible to hope for? A group of French women criticise the Me Too anti-harassment campaign. And how much do the worlds of gambling and hedge funds have in common? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Henry Rees-Sheridan. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Joy Lodico, columnist at the London Evening Standard, and John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. The conservative website Breitbart News is named after its founder, the late provocateur Andrew Breitbart. But over the course of 2016, it became synonymous with the name of a different man, Steve Bannon. Bannon became the organisation's executive chairman in 2012 after Breitbart died, and it was under his guidance that the website aligned itself with Trump's presidential campaign and the grassroots alt-right conservative movement that fuelled it. But now Bannon's been ousted from Breitbart less than a week after a row blew up over remarks attributed to him criticising Donald Trump's children. Joy, the proximate cause of Bannon's downfall is the publication of Michael Wolff's sensational expose, Fire and Fury. Why did Bannon make these comments to Wolff? And do you think he's regretting them now?
I imagine he is regretting them now, but I think Bannon has always been a bit of a loose cannon and he's always been a bit of a provocateur. And Michael Wolff is a man who can get somebody talking. People I know have spoken to Bannon in the past couple of months say he's quite loose-lipped, he's chatty, he's quite happy to make his position clear on various things. And I should also imagine that he was feeling rather stung at being thrown out of the White House, and the way you kind of keep in with it or keep in with the story is to continue to talk about it.
So you think it's simply a case of sloppy Steve?
I think
Trump's new term for Bannon having a grain of truth in it.
Well, I wouldn't say the Trump administration is the tightest on its kind of press control anyway, and solid messaging. So it's just another example of how the Trump administration has been running and why Bannon was there in the first place.
So, John, people have said that this ouster from Breitbart specifically was initiated by Rebecca Mercer. She's a minority stakeholder in the Breitbart organisation and an estranged financial patron from Bannon. They split up last week, I think. What do we need to know about her and the family she comes from and their relationship to Breitbart?
To explain how this all fits into Steve Bannon's sudden departure, all we need to know is that the Mercer family have got a great deal of money, and that losing that money would not quite cut Breitbart off at the knees, but it would very severely clip its wings. And I think it's not difficult to imagine the kind of conversations going on between Steve Bannon's fellow directors, that if they kept Steve Bannon on, there must have been a severe risk that that money would simply dry up. And they were simply not prepared to take that risk. And at some point, I suspect they formed up to him and said, Steve, don't you want voluntarily to go now? And that would have been it.
Except Breitbart, since he returned to it, has started rising and rising again in the rankings, to the point where now, according to Alexa, it's now rivaling the Washington Post. It's something like the 50th biggest website in the US. Without Bannon, Breitbart was just falling off the radar.
Yes, there must have been that conversation around that too.
So you're losing your kind of A-lister.
Maybe they think they can get somebody else in. Maybe they think that Bannon has now brought Breitbart up to the kind of level where they can just hold it there even without him. Who knows what went on behind closed doors?
It's interesting, too, isn't it, that this seems to reveal that Breitbart still, as a website, has enough fealty to the Trump administration, or at least the broader conservative movement that brought him to power, that it's willing to oust one of its own, so to speak, in order to maintain I suppose, affiliation with the Trump administration. Do you think that it will continue to tack in that direction throughout the duration of the rest of the administration, or where else could it go?
I don't know. I mean, it is clearly closely identified with alt-right. That's quite clear. But quite how closely Breitbart still feels itself affiliated with Trump is not yet clear. I think, particularly now that Trump is, in Breitbart's view, going off the rails, going to Davos, for heaven's sake. There must be a certain amount of muttering in the corridors of power in Breitbart about what that relationship should now be. And I think also that there must be some feeling in Breitbart that there's room for a clear voice of the alt-right that is not Trumpist.
Sorry, Joy, do you want to jump in?
Well, I do, actually. I think Bannon has said that he would destroy Trump were he to begin to diverge from the sort of social democratic policies that Bannon put through. Think of them what you will. Going to Davos is exactly that. Now, Bannon was an absolute cannon. He could, in fact, have turned Breitbart into the most extraordinary attack dog on Trump, which would have possibly taken some of that base with him and also picked up the liberals who suddenly would have followed. So by removing Bannon, you're removing possibly one of the most interesting media switches and future media switches that could have happened.
George, yes. do you think we've overestimated Bannon? He has had some missteps recently, most notably perhaps with the support of Roy Moore in the Alabama Senate race, which went disastrously wrong. Now, this seems to have been, what's happening to him now seems to ultimately be the consequence of mistakes made by him. There's been an awful lot of attention paid to him in recent years, particularly since he came on board with the Trump campaign. Has he been distracting us from perhaps other important sources of power within the conservative movement? Should we have been giving him as much attention as we have been?
Well, I think, yes, initially. I mean, yes, up until about 6 months ago, at which point he was sidelined, and then he became the sort of outsider and the attacker. There have been a number of people influencing Donald Trump. You know, for example, Bannon and Kushner went head-to-head on subjects like China. So you had to actually look at the entire pool of people around Donald Trump to see who was influencing him. Have we paid too much attention to him? Was he a fraud in the first place? Is the President of the United States, you know, infallible? I think the answer is, you know, whoever's close to power is a person to pay attention to.
And John, where can he go from here? He lives in a townhouse in Washington, which has been called Breitbart Embassy. At least a rebranding is in order.
Yes, some fundamental change, certainly. Where can he go? He's taken two heavy knocks in quick succession. I mean, thrown out of the White House, and to judge by the tone of his remarks following Foreign Fury, that's a move that has hurt him quite deeply. And now, of course, being forced out of Breitbart. I suspect that there will be a short pause, that Steve Bannon will want to pause, to reflect, to think about what he does next. But Steve Bannon is a man consumed with anger and resentment against a world that he sees as fundamentally wrong in all kinds of ways. And I very much doubt that we've seen the last of this man. I suspect he will bounce back in some form or other. But how he will do it, I'd be guessing.
And Joy, finally, is it meaningful to chalk this up as a win for Donald Trump or not? Specifically Breitbart's firing of Bannon?
That's a very interesting question. No, because I think Bannon is now a loose cannon and sort of uncontrollable. He only has about 50,000 followers on Twitter. However, he just has the ability to do a bugle call to various people. So I think, you know, in a sense, Trump at least knew where he was when he was at Breitbart.
Let's move on now from the US to the Korean Peninsula. Over the past year, Hostilities between North and South Korea have escalated with no end in sight, except perhaps the terrifying spectre of a war on the peninsula. But yesterday, a two-year diplomatic standoff between the countries ended. The meeting between officials from both sides opened with an agreement that North Korea will send athletes and cheerleaders to the Winter Olympics in South Korea's Pyeongchang next month. It's a promising start, but will the rapprochement lead to anything more than a trip for the North Olympic delegation? John, I will defer to you pretty much throughout this topic. How optimistic should we be?
We should be cautiously optimistic. If I were a champagne drinker, I would be keeping the champagne firmly on ice and the cork in the bottle for the time being. We've only been through one and a bit round of talks so far, and they've gone well, but then initial rounds of talks with North Koreans usually do go well. It's standard North Korean practice that you are ever so nice to the person on the other side of the table for the first round, and you come in for the kill later on. If I were to speculate on what the North Koreans are doing, it's that to draw the South Koreans out as far as they possibly can, get them hooked on as many goodies as they can manage. North Korean participation in the Olympics, something that President Moon said he wanted even before he came to power. Civic society contacts, another great South Korean ask. Family reunions now being discussed. And then when you've got them on all this, just before the Olympics, you turn round and you say, actually, of course, fellow Koreans, none of this will be possible unless you drop your adherence to these wicked US-led sanctions.
So a bait and switch.
I think is what's going on. Interesting that the North Koreans tried very hard to allow television cameras into the negotiating room, which of course would allow them to grandstand. The South saw that trick and stopped it.
Joy, focusing specifically on this Olympic development, it was a very kind of warm and fuzzy note for the first meeting between the two countries for 2 years to kick off on. And there have been some questions raised about the ethics of allowing North Korea to compete in the Olympics. Russia has been banned from sending a team because of its doping. South Africa was banned for decades because of apartheid from the Summer Olympics. Is there an argument to be made that North Korea shouldn't be allowed to compete because of its atrocious treatment of its own citizens? Or, on the other hand, could you say that, you know, the diplomatic stakes here outweigh the potential dragging through the muck of the image of the Olympics, as if it needs any more?
Well, big sporting competitions traditionally are a place of soft power, whereby you can actually forge alliances, talk to each other. Teams from opposing sides, you know, from either side of the Iron Curtain could play each other in the World Cup. It's also a great opportunity for defections as well, but that's besides the point. But sport is very useful in the fact that you put two countries on a level playing field, quite literally, or, you know, in the winter case of the Winter Olympics, the same ski slope. And if you are then going to have to try and do some hard diplomacy in the background, you have at least treated and looked the other person in the eye as an equal, and it's kind of a great act of respect.
And so you think let them compete?
Absolutely.
It will do more good than harm.
I think if we're going to start doing banning people for human rights abuses, I think the Olympics would slim down quite considerably and become a much shorter competition.
And John, focusing still on the Olympics, I'm really interested in the specific people that are going to comprise the North Korean delegation. They're going to send athletes, obviously, also a cheering squad, an art troupe. I'm not sure what that is. Maybe you can enlighten me. A visitors group as well.
A taekwondo demonstration team. That's the fun bit.
Okay, and that demonstration team will be separate from... Well, of course, there's no taekwondo in the Winter Olympics, sorry. I'm confusing the Winter and Summer Olympics there. Now, will this delegation specifically be mobilised? And what will the North be aiming to get out of the optics of the Winter Olympics and their participation in it?
First, let's remember that there's only two North Korean athletes who are going to participate actually in the Olympics, two figure skaters. So the great majority of the delegation are going to be non-athletes, all the people we've been talking about. What are the North Koreans hoping to get out of this? They want to make their mark as clearly as possible, both for their own prestige and also to give the South Koreans face. They know that North Korean participation in the Olympics was a big South Korean ask. So the more North Koreans who turn up and cheer or demonstrate taekwondo, whatever it is, the bigger that participation is visibly. So there's that angle to it too. I suspect that there will be a certain amount of fraternising between the two Korean teams. There has been in previous occasions. I mean, the two Koreas have at one point actually marched under the same flag at Olympics in times gone by. And that may help some softening. But alongside the participation in the Olympics, Marshal Kim Jong-un, in his New Year's speech, made clear that, apart from the Olympics, he wants proper talks with the South on quite a wide range of subjects. So I suspect that serious talks will be going on during the Olympics, perhaps in a different forum.
And what? Sorry, Joe, do you want to jump in there? No, you didn't want to. No, I'm also really interested again in the minutiae of this. What about the possibility of defections? Because I don't think was there a football tournament relatively recently that the North participated in that didn't go swimmingly? Or tell me.
Yes, there have been problems with North Korean sports people defecting, but at the Olympics, no, this is not going to happen. I mean,
why specifically?
Because you can bet your bottom dollar that buried amongst this quite large North Korean delegation, there are goons and heavies who will make very, very sure that the two figure skaters come back nice and safe.
Joy, as I think we've mentioned several times already, one of the prospects that was raised as part of the talks, a very emotional one, reuniting families that were separated during the Korean War. Now, I'll ask John in a bit about the feasibility of this going forward, but, you know, guessing it can happen, do you think it's almost a cruel proposition to hold that out as a diplomatic carrot if it's going to be only a temporary reunited situation?
I think what I'm quite interested in is how, I mean, South Korea, obviously this will be in the media. I'm interested to know whether the North Koreans are aware of such an offer and, you know, whether that's actually been communicated to the people, because obviously there's a sort of, you know, histories of families which have been split. It's a very emotional point to sort of say, well, you can finally meet your kind of sister again if you've not seen them for 60 years. Will it be cruel? I would imagine that it's, you know, incredibly important as part of the diplomacy. I mean, you know, every time we do rounds of diplomacy, we see, even with the EU and Brexit, actually family reunion is a sort of huge deal. This obviously is forced disunion.
Yes, sure. Perhaps I can come on to that. It hasn't been announced to the North Korean people. That's to say, the North Korean media have covered nothing of this, but that is exactly what you'd expect. If it goes ahead, they will, however, know quite quickly. The numbers involved, although they're dwindling as the Grim Reaper takes his toll, are still quite large. Somebody counted a possible 60,000 people altogether on both sides who could meet different family members. And the North Koreans have got a simple system, or at least they have in the past. They know where these people are. It's a heavily registered society. And they simply go and tell them that they are being considered for participation in family reunions. Now, North Koreans, I mean, we think of them as sort of automatons. They're not. They're Koreans. They are incurably garrulous. And they will chatter away to their friends, their close associates, and word that this is going on will spread through North Korean, through the chattering classes in North Korea, who are really quite well informed, very quickly. So the news will get out, though not through official channels.
But John, to clarify, the news, no such news has got out before. There haven't previously been reunited families between the North and South, have
there?
No,
there have been reunions. Okay. Indeed, there's a great big a complex for this very purpose in Kumgangsan, right on the eastern coast of the two Koreas. The way that the North Koreans usually handle it is to let the reunions go ahead and announce afterwards that it's happened, rather than announce it before. So it does get into the media, but just afterwards rather than before.
Got it. Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Henry Rees-Sheridan, Joy Lodico and John Everard. Coming up next, a letter in France's most prestigious broadsheet says the Me Too anti-sexual harassment movement might have gone too far.
Who's up, who's down and who's out? As the world begins to hunker down for the holidays, we unwrap our annual Soft Power Survey and much more in Monocle's bumper December-January double edition. In a tumultuous year for global politics, we play snakes and ladders with the world's soft power rankings, revealing whose worsening image abroad has seen them take a downward slide and which nations on the charm offensive are climbing to success. We also visit a tiny country with a rich history, San Marino, the world's oldest republic and a nation proud to defend its traditions, crossbow in hand. Next, we grab our first class tickets, head to our favourite airline lounge and jet into Monocle's annual Travel Top 50. From revamped modernist hotels to the best new high-speed trains, we pack a year's worth of travel highlights into this comprehensive survey. Our voyage continues into the inner workings of National Geographic in our culture pages as we take a peek behind that famous yellow border to see how one of the world's most coveted print titles remain relevant in an ever-changing world. The best is saved until last for you this festive season as our inventory pages unveil Monocle's Christmas gift guide featuring 200 plus present suggestions. From wine and cheese to technology and tools, there's something in here for even the finickiest of friends and family. Monocle's December-January issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Henry Rhys-Sheridan. Still with me are John Everard and Joy Lodico. Let's continue to France now, where the actress Catherine Deneuve has said that men should be, quote, free to hit on, end quote, women. She's one of 100 French women who wrote an open letter warning about a new puritanism sparked by recent sexual harassment scandals. The letter was published in France's Le Monde newspaper. Joy, what exactly is this letter saying? And are you surprised by it?
Actually, I'm not at all surprised by it. The letter is basically saying that, you know, the world is full of attempted seductions and Me Too has stifled a lot of people and that a hand on the knee or a clumsy pass is not something that should be criminalised. And it goes on to point out that a number of men have now been hauled in by their companies, sacked, so forth, for making approaches to women. And Deneuve and the other signatories are saying, come on, the world goes round. We do understand that there's some severe cases that really should not be happening, and there's criminal procedure for that. But we should not be getting upset about a misdirected comment or an embarrassing lunge at somebody.
The point of men having been put in the wrong category, I think, is the language that they use in the letter. It's a controversial one, isn't it? Because the underreporting of rape and the under-prosecution of perpetrators has been well documented. So is making the point that, you know, some men will be accused for lesser crimes and put in the same category a legitimate one to make at this stage, given the current inadequacies of legislation and enforcement in this field, do you think?
So you could look at it two ways. First of all, if it's somebody is just making a clumsy pass, it is not the same as rape. And therefore, to sit there and have this as a sort of fluid category into which they all fall is a little bit ridiculous. In terms of underreporting of rape, that is absolutely correct. And if you are reporting people for much more minor things, it may come to pass that you begin to add up the numbers and begin to realise that somebody is a serial pest approaching numbers of women and making them feel all uncomfortable. Which has happened in Britain, where there are similar conversations going on. But again, you have to ask the question, is rape sort of equivalent to, you know, a hand drifting down, you know, one's leg when you don't really want it?
I mean, coming off that point of comparing Britain to France, I'm struck that it's difficult to imagine, I think, such a letter being published in even a conservative English language newspaper, particularly in Britain. John, what does the letter reveal, if anything, about French culture and the way these debates play out in France?
To be honest, if you're looking for differences between French culture in this aspect and British culture, I'm not convinced that the letter really does show anything very much. No, the British Conservative press might have handled it slightly differently, but the kind of things that were in that letter seem to me to reflect concerns on both sides of the Channel. This isn't just a French phenomenon. It sounds a lot better in French, I have to say, but that the concepts are probably universal.
I think it's also wonderful that it's Catherine Deneuve who is the person who writes the letter. I mean, she's not a woman to whom many men would make a pass, because they would just be absolutely terrified of the rejection. But she's also talking about, you know, if you are felt up on the metro, is it the worst thing? She and the other signatories. And no, but I can't imagine Catherine Deneuve actually takes the metro in the first place. So it's a particularly kind of, sophisticated group of French women who are writing this, and they will have particular sorts of men approaching them in the first place.
I mean, the way, I think the language, some of the language which it's been translated into, I can't read French, but is a bit, well, somewhat loaded, I think. I mean, one sentence from the translated letter is, "We defend a freedom to bother, indispensable to sexual freedom." Isn't the fact that the line between bothering and harassment is too thin exactly the source of the problem in the first place?
It's a really difficult question, because what it is it's perceived offence. And where one person won't be offended at all, the next person will. The other problem is, for all our talk, for all women's talk of equality, predominantly it is still men making the approaches to women. Culturally it is beginning to change, but it's always going to be the men who are hauled up for this, because women aren't lunging at men in quite the same way. I mean, it's far more subtle and usually in sort of written form rather than, being taken out for dinner and intentions being made clear.
Where you are looking at the division, the fine line, as you rightly say, Henry, between a clumsy approach and harassment, essentially you are relying on the judgment of the man to predict the reaction of the woman to an approach. If you say that that any approach of this kind that is unwelcome constitutes harassment, you come very close to effectively banning sexual approaches by an awful lot of men. It would mean, for example, no sex lives for autistic people. Is that really what you want?
There's also another interesting terminology in there, a bit of terminology in there, which is they write that these are some of the pitfalls that come with freedom. So if you think that women's liberation basically meant that you didn't have to be sort of wandering around, with a brother escorting you everywhere, that you were free to go into society, that you were free to interact, this is part of what happens. And to try and take it away again and return to an almost kind of Victorian idea of, chaperones and women's purity, it in fact takes away far more.
Yes, I agree. And I think there's another aspect of this too. We're talking here about approaches that women don't want. I mean, it is not unknown for a woman to actually welcome an approach from a man. And are we in danger here of creating a world where men are simply too concerned that they're going to get sued, badly rejected, damaged in some way, and that a couple who might otherwise have found happiness are denied that simply because the man's too afraid?
Joy, last word to you, and extremely quickly, has the debate in general played out in a way which is, to your mind, sensible? I'm talking about around the Me Too campaign.
No, because I think there is a group of older women, which is, as Deneuve is one of them, who have actually been silenced by the fact that it's all become very politically correct. There is still a debate going on.
Finally, on today's show, before we say goodbye, it's been reported that Vanessa Selbst, the world's most successful poker player, has joined the world's biggest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates. Hedge funds have in recent years turned to unconventional ways of acquiring fresh talent that can help boost their performance. But does this move reveal unnerving similarities between gambling and the world of finance? Joy, I understand neither of those worlds. Can you enlighten me at all, or not?
Well, I don't know. I'm accidentally a very good poker player. I never know the rules. I sit down at a table and I seem to win quite regularly, and then I don't play it again for 2 years.
Well done.
However, stock markets and companies, I'm not so good at. I think it's strangely cynical because, we always talk about the stock markets as being a casino, and hedge funds betting against them is actually quite cynical. The poker player is normally just playing with their own money, and it's their own risk. When you actually start talking about them playing with other companies for the fun of it, it's a bit of a dark world, really. There are businesses, lives, money to be lost.
Yeah, I was intrigued by this story. I mean, I think it shows such an overlap between poker playing and what hedge funds do. Essentially, both hedge funds and poker players have to make decisions based on what they think is going on in the heads of other people on the basis of very limited and usually woefully inadequate information. There is a much closer overlap between the two than we really imagine.
But you make a profit out of somebody else's loss, and it's very direct in a game of poker, and it's very direct in hedge funds.
Yes, that too.
I found it interesting to hear about attempts to recruit talent from other companies as well. Apparently there's one called Citadel, who hosted a year's worth of data science competitions at prestigious universities in the US to attract students who might otherwise be recruited to Silicon Valley. And it got me thinking, have young people been so put off by the predatory image of hedge funds that I think they've had since 2007, if not before, and seduced by the techno glamour of Silicon Valley? Has there been a generational shift here?
Well, I think there's still quite a lot to be said to be a kind of cool Silicon Valley kid. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily go around boasting you were working for a hedge fund. What I don't know is statistics is who makes more money in the end if you're successful.
Yes. I have to say, I've got to go into rant mode here. One of the things that so saddens me about graduates is that they're drawn by all these glamorous jobs, whether it's hedge funds or playing poker for that matter, you know, things where you get your face in the media and so on. If people were attracted to things like building better roads or sewage and water management, where instances where you simply cannot get top flight graduates, wouldn't the world be a better place?
Well, you can try and pitch that at the next careers fair and see how you do.
Well, that is all we have time for today's show. John Everard, Joe Lodico, thank you very much for joining us. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. I'm Henry Sheridan. Goodbye.